This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I would like to first to introduce our first speaker of the afternoon, who is Dr. Adia Spinks Franklin. Dr. Spinks Franklin is a cisgender African-American woman who is board certified in developmental behavioral pediatrics with more than 20 years of experience evaluating and caring for children with developmental disabilities and behavioral health conditions. She holds leadership positions in several national pediatric organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics. She is a lifelong warrior against oppressive systems. She is a wife, mother, and grandmother, and has a farm in Texas. She identifies as Wonder Woman. Dr. Spinks Franklin will now talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much, Dr. Takayama. I am a cinnamon brown, middle-aged, fluffy African-American woman. I'm wearing glasses. I have my black dreadlocks all curly for y'all, looking cute. I have on a necklace that is a pearl necklace and a light blue shirt. I have no relevant financial disclosures. I wish I did, but I would like to disclose that my personal identities, my family history, and my lived experience really shape my worldview and my clinical practice just like yours do. Now, I am using 24-point minimum Sans Serif font. I have used alternative text for all images in this presentation, and please turn on closed captioning if you need it. This is for digital accessibility. Now, I like to start by honoring our ancestors. I want to first acknowledge and honor our first American ancestors on whose land we occupy. Coming to you from Indian Country, Oklahoma City, and my third great grandfather was Cherokee. His name was Squire. He was enslaved on the Big Springs Plantation in Tennessee. And I want to acknowledge that we are on Turtle Island, and all of us are a part of the colonial settler structure. And if we are going to uplift and center first American communities, as Mrs. Goodpasture helped us to educate and illuminate us today, then we need to start buying products from first American organizations and companies and businesses. And we need to start researching and reading articles written by first American researchers and reading books written by first American folk. So even the coffee I drink and the coffee mug I drink out of come from first American people. So I say Ashe, and I honor the first American brothers, sisters, and elders. Also, I want to acknowledge our African ancestors who were terrorized throughout the 400-year Ma'afa. That includes the invasion of sub-Saharan Africa by the European colonizers and the bondage and enslavement and the kidnapping of hundreds of millions of Africans who were taken to the Western Hemisphere across the Middle Passage. My fourth great grandmother was Huldi. She was taken from the Gold Coast of Guinea and taken to a plantation in Big Springs, Tennessee. And so we honor the ancestors who survived the Middle Passage so we could be here today, those who resisted and rebelled their enslavement, and those who did not survive. And to your right is a map of 1935 of all the states that had eugenics laws, y'all. These are the laws where they were required to forcibly sterilize disabled people who were considered to be unfit for being parents. Eugenics laws really helped to be the basis of scientific racism and scientific ableism and medical racism and medical ableism. And although eugenics laws were overturned during the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Revolution, we still see the spirit of eugenics today, where disabled people are still forcibly sterilized across the United States without their consent. So I want you to honor your own ancestors. So we're using Poll Everywhere. The instructions are at the top of the screen. You can join using the QR code if you are able to use the camera on your smartphone. You can join on the web, the internet, or you can join by text message on the instructions on the slide. Honor your ancestors and click on where your great-grandparents were born. So we'll just stay here for a few seconds, let folk holla about their great grandparents. I'm all about acknowledging the ancestors. We got folks coming from all over the world, y'all. Southeast Asia, from the Pacific Islands, from all over North America, from Europe. We're gonna holla. If it wasn't for the ancestors, y'all, we wouldn't be here today. So ashe to the ancestors. Thank you for honoring your ancestors, y'all. All right, so this is what we're gonna cover today. So Dr. Takayama gave me an impossible task, which is to talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in 30 minutes. So I'm gonna do my best. I got my little timer here that I got from Lakeshore Learning. So we're gonna talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and their subtypes. Then we will describe the common behaviors that are exhibited by youth who have FASDs. Then we will review the societal risks that folks with FASDs face. And then we're going to talk about some evidence-based interventions. All right. So let's first start off with two facts I want you to remember and keep at the forefront of your brains throughout this entire presentation. Fact number one, there is no safe amount of alcohol to consume during pregnancy. And I know that there are some OBs out there telling these pregnant folk, oh, you can have you a little sip of wine every now and then to calm your nerves. No, you don't. There is no safe amount of alcohol to consume during pregnancy. Fact number two, as my friend Douglas Waite says, FASD is in the brain, y'all, not the face. FASD is in the brain. We're going to have a pop quiz about this later. Okay, y'all ready? And I'm loud because I'm the first speaker after lunch, and some of y'all going to get sleepy, and I'm going to call you out if you fall asleep. All right, so let's talk about FASDs and their subtypes. So, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are a group of neurodevelopmental disabilities that are caused by prenatal alcohol exposure. Okay. Now, PAE is the acronym for prenatal alcohol exposure. So if you see PAE in your notes, the handout that you can download from the website is comprehensive, y'all. It is comprehensive. What I'm showing you today is truncated because y'all, I got 28 minutes. So now, ethanol, and I'm going to use the chemical formula ETOH because it's just shorter to type. So ethanol causes damage to the developing nervous system, and the damage caused to the embryo or the fetus is lifelong. Remember this. So because ethanol is a teratogen. It is a teratogen, y'all. Every substance taken is not a teratogen. Ethanol is. And when a person is pregnant, there's a higher concentration of ethanol in the placental fluid than there is in that pregnant person's serum. That means that the fetus, remember the embryo, the fetus is like a little parasite, right? So everything that goes into the pregnant person's body is being sucked into the placenta by the fetus to nourish the fetus. Unfortunately, that includes the good and the bad. So the fetus ends up being pickled. It is swimming in ethanol, okay? Now, let's look at the prevalence of ethanol usage worldwide. The lighter the blue, the lower the prevalence. The darker the blue, the higher the prevalence. So you can see that the highest prevalence of ethanol use during pregnancy occurs in Europe, especially in the Eastern Bloc, right? Where the Soviet Union used to be. The second highest is us, y'all. North America has the second highest prevalence in the world. And the lowest prevalence, the Middle East. Muslim nations report the lowest level, almost zero alcohol use because of the Muslim belief in abstinence from alcohol and other substances. Isn't that amazing? Now, when you look at countries worldwide where pregnancy alcohol use is common, it is most common among people with historical and colonial trauma. Ms. Goodpasture talked about colonial trauma. So you will see alcohol consumption highest among those populations. Why is that? That's a whole nother seminar I can bring y'all. But let me just tell you real quick the cliff notes. The cliff notes is that ethanol was used as a weapon of war by the colonizers when they colonized these nations. Right? And then ethanol became the conduit for coping with colonial trauma, right? So first it was the weapon that was introduced, then it became the means of coping. And so that leads to transgenerational transfer of trauma. That's the cliff notes. There is a lot you can read. If you PubMed it, you can read it for yourself. All right, now, what counts as a drink? So a drink is not taking your big old cup, your big gulp from 7-Eleven and filling it up with your favorite flavor of Jack Daniels. That is not one drink. Here are the US standard one drink. That is a 12-ounce can of beer, which has 5% ethanol. That is one drink. That is 5 ounces of your favorite table wine that has 12% alcohol. That is one drink. What's your favorite liquor? That is 1.5%. I'm sorry, 1.5 ounces. These are each considered one drink. Okay? Remember that as we talk about that throughout this seminar today. So what is binge drinking? Binge drinking is when you consume a whole lot of ethanol real fast. So for women, we're talking about XX, we're talking about sex, okay? We're not talking about gender identity. So among the sex, the female sex, 4 drinks in a 2 hour period is binge drinking. And for the male sex, 5 drinks in a 2 hour period is binge drinking. We've already defined what one drink is, right? That's 4 cans of beer, 4 glasses of wine, or 4 cans of beer, 4 glasses of wine, or 4 shots of whiskey. Now, worldwide, 25% of pregnant people who actually consume alcohol binge drink, y'all. So of all the folks who drink during their pregnancy, a quarter of them are binge drinking. And remember that 40% of pregnant folk who drink alcohol are also using other substances: marijuana, meth, cocaine, opioids, etc. So let's look at FASDs. The prevalence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder kind of aligns with the prevalence of alcohol use. So of course, the highest, look at this, Southern Africa, a colonized population of people, right? You see in Europe, you see in North America, really high rates of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. But what the studies are finding, and honestly, y'all, I'm not quite sure how they came, not fully understanding how they came to this statistic, but what they say is 1 in 13 fetuses that are exposed to alcohol prenatally will end up having fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Isn't that interesting? 1 in 13. So that means most fetuses that are not exposed to alcohol prenatally won't end up with an FASD, but 1 in 13 will. Regardless of that, y'all, there is no safe amount of alcohol to drink during pregnancy. Now, what are some of the risks? What are some of the things about the pregnant person that are risk factors that the fetus could end up having fetal alcohol spectrum disorders? Well, there are some genetic risk factors, like if you have polymorphisms of your alcohol dehydrogenase drink genes, and you are a slow metabolizer of ethanol, and your alcohol gets broken down into alcohol dehydrogenase, and that stays in your system for a long time. I mean, alcohol. Oh Lord, I can't remember. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm having a menopause moment. Forgive me. Those who've been through menopause understand what I'm talking about. I lost my thought. Anyhow, if you have polymorphisms for alcohol dehydrogenase and alcohol stays in the system longer and it isn't cleared, then that means that the fetus is exposed to ethanol for a longer period of time for a higher concentration. Also, preconception heavy alcohol consumption places the fetus at risk because if the person drank a lot of alcohol before they got pregnant, then they're going to be drinking a lot of alcohol before they find out they're pregnant, right? Even though their body is pregnant. And then having a delayed pregnancy diagnosis where you don't even realize you're pregnant until like the second trimester and you've continued to consume ethanol. And then if there's poor nutrition through pregnancy, which happens in pregnant folks who are experiencing being unhoused or domestic violence or in abject poverty and they don't have access to good food. Well, what they're finding is poor nutrition can actually potentiate the impact of ethanol on the fetus. Isn't that something? So there's no protection for the fetus. And so, as we've already talked about, there is a higher concentration of ethanol in the placenta than there is in the parent's serum. So let's talk about ethanol and fetal development. There is a whole lot of really sexy data about this. Now, much of it is done in mouse models, but there is also quite a bit done in humans. So the timing, the pattern, the dose, and the duration really make a difference. So when we're looking at timing, we know that organogenesis happens in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy before most folks ever know that they're pregnant. So that's when you lay down the foundations of every organ system, including the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, the lungs, right, the kidneys, et cetera. So consuming ethanol during this time, when a person doesn't even know and realize that they're pregnant, really puts them at higher risk of the teratogenic effects of ethanol. In other words, all the organs being damaged, right? Well, because it affects the development of the primary organ systems in those first 8 weeks when it is an embryo. The pattern of ethanol consumption matters too. So there is a difference in how the fetus is affected if there is repeated exposure throughout pregnancy versus exposure to ethanol during these critical periods of embryonic and fetal development. Okay. So the way ethanol affects the baby when it's born, when you see the effects of it, really depends on how they were the pattern in which they were exposed. And then let's look at the dose. What they have found, y'all, is that if the pregnant person consumes less than 1.5 drinks per occasion, that is enough to cause fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Or if they consume less than 5 drinks a week, that is enough. In fact, there are some studies that suggest that this dose alone is enough to even cause the facial changes that we can see. And the duration of exposure to ethanol makes a difference too. Being exposed to ethanol during the first trimester as a fetus. So let's say the pregnant person finds out at 11 weeks gestation that they are pregnant and they stop consuming ethanol for the duration of the pregnancy. Well, the damage that was caused at that time would not continue to progress, right, over the course of the pregnancy. But if the pregnant person continues to consume ethanol throughout the pregnancy, then you will see a multiplication of damage to the fetal nervous system and other organ systems because of repeated and ongoing exposure. Okay, so let's talk about the parts of the brain. Remember, FASD is in the brain, y'all, not in the face. Lots of things happen to this developing brain. You have reduced neurogenesis, so you have fewer neurons actually being developed. And then you've got disruption of neural migration, where the brain cells go to the different parts of the brain for their different jobs, right? And then impairment of the differentiation of the brain cells, because different brain cells have different jobs, right? Some of them see, some of them hear, some of them talk, right? Okay. And then you have reduction in synaptogenesis, which are the connections between the neurons, between the brain cells. So you have fewer connections between brain cells. And then you end up with decreased gyrification, y'all. So that means the brain doesn't get as wrinkly in the brains that are exposed to alcohol compared to brains not exposed to alcohol. Then you have neural apoptosis. That means that more neurons die at an earlier age in the fetus that is exposed to ethanol. So overall, what do we end up with? We end up with smaller brain volumes in a whole lot of regions of the brain. You have a less developed brain. This is brain damage caused by ethanol. So it's lifelong. Does that make sense, y'all? Okay, so here's your pop quiz. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, are they in the face or are they in the brain? Check A for face, check B for brain. Just want to make sure y'all are awake and listening. We got 5 responses so far. Okay, 8, 9, 10. Lovely. Thank you, y'all. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are in the brain. They're in the brain. Oops, somebody clicked face. Okay, then they changed it. Okay, good job. Good job. Somebody finger slipped. So, y'all are awake. Excellent. Now, talk about these classification systems. Okay, y'all. So I am now the lead author of the AAP's Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders updated policy statement. And one of the things that is really challenging is all of the various classification systems we have in the US. We have 4. You got the DSM-5, you got the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, you've got the University of Washington 4-digit code in the CDC. And then worldwide, there's like 11 different classification systems. There's a lot of debates, a lot of confusion over diagnostic rubrics. And I think this contributes to why a lot of pediatricians don't end up appropriately diagnosing FASDs. But we're going to lean on the NIAAA criteria today, just so you have one rubric to go by. So these are the 5 FASD classifications from the NIAAA. We're going to talk about each one of these briefly. These are more detailed in your handout. So fetal alcohol syndrome, that's the first thing that was characterized back in the 1950s and 1960s, right? This is the one everybody thinks about, but this is the least common one, y'all. This is the least common one. You're rarely gonna see this one, actually. So this is where children have those characteristic facial anomalies. So you've got the small eyes, the shortened palpebral fissure, you have the smooth philtrum, you have the thin vermilion border on the upper lip, which makes the upper lip look thin, right? And then you've got growth deficiency, which means these babies are small. Either they're born small for gestational age or IUGR, or postnatally, they're small children. And then you have evidence of neurological damage, right? So you have a microcephaly, a small brain. They might have a disrupted corpus callosum on neuroimaging. They may have a seizure disorder. They might have an intellectual disability, right? And then you've got some kind of behavioral problem and developmental delay. So when you've got all of these, then you don't even have to necessarily prove alcohol exposure prenatally because you've got the sentinel classic features of alcohol exposure. Does that make sense? But when you're looking at the other categories, you've got to have documented alcohol exposure. So partial fetal alcohol syndrome is where you've got the characteristic facial features and you've got some sort of growth deficiency, either the body or microcephaly, right, in the brain. And then you've got some kind of behavioral impairment. Next is alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. And this is where there's documented prenatal alcohol exposure. And with that, you've got some type of neurobehavioral problem. You've got a cognitive impairment, like a learning disability or intellectual disability, or you've got disruptive behavior, some type of behavior impairment. Next is alcohol-related birth defects. So you've got documented prenatal alcohol exposure, and then one or more birth malformations, congenital heart lesions, kidney anomalies, skeletal malformations, eye anomalies, hearing loss. You have some type of a birth defect, okay? And then you've got this DSM classification, neurobehavioral disorder associated with prenatal alcohol exposure, which is really a mouthful. So this is a classification when you've got one or more deficits in your neurocognition and your self-regulation, and then two or more deficits in adaptive functioning, like your communication skills, your independent living skills, et cetera. Okay. All right, let's move on to our second one. We're going to describe some common behaviors that are exhibited in folks who have FASDs. So I just have a big old list here. And this is in more detail in your handout that you can download from the website. But you see generally poor self-regulation. So that's poor attention regulation and activity and impulse control, right? And that's an overlap with a lot of conditions. But something that's really unique about FASDs, these kids don't have good cause and effect. They don't understand the consequences of their actions, and they don't understand why they get in trouble for things. And so they tend to do the same thing over and over again and get in trouble for it because they don't see cause and effect. They also struggle with ownership. So they look like they're stealing. So they'll take stuff. They see a shiny, colorful pencil, and nobody's holding it, and it's not in someone's lap. So they'll just take it, right? Because they don't understand ownership. Another thing is confabulation or lying. These children lie. Bless their hearts. And a lot of times they don't realize they're lying. They just make stuff up because they can't think the correct answer on time. Learning problems, especially in math, are very common, and terrible executive functioning. Bless their hearts. Really struggle with planning, organizing, and executing. And so you see these kids forgetting the rules. They have to be reminded of the rules concretely very often. Lord, I put executive dysfunction twice because it is a huge issue. They have a really hard time with perspective taking and theory of mind. So they struggle with social boundaries and being a good friend and making a good friend and keeping good friends. They struggle with their judgment. They've got sleep problems, anxiety and mood issues, sensory sensitivities. So you'll see a lot of overlap with other conditions. But remember, one in 20 kids have an FASD. It's more common than autism, right? And so if you've got a dysregulated kid, don't first jump to ADHD. First think about FASDs. So here are the coexisting conditions. Folks with FASDs are commonly diagnosed with ADHD. So if you look at the literature, they'll say, oh gosh, a huge number, like 50 or more percent have ADHD. But let me tell you something that I worry about. Since I've been doing this for so long, what I have observed is diagnostic overshadowing. So folks will say the child has ADHD. Everybody forgets that we actually have an etiology, right? We have prenatal alcohol exposure. This kid has a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. That's why they're dysregulated. And so when we say ADHD, people completely forget everything else. And the traditional treatments for ADHD may not be effective for kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders because the cause of their ADHD is the alcohol damage. You can see substance use, which is really sad. And the reason they're at a higher risk for substance use disorder is because of their own trauma and ACEs. Kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are more likely, for example, to live in a household with adults that have untreated mental illness and untreated substance use disorders. So they're at a higher risk of trauma and ACEs, and they end up using substances to cope. And of course, we talked about learning disorders. And remember, seizures and intellectual disabilities and language disorders. So now let's talk about societal risk factors. This is a part of the talk. It's actually really sad because whenever we misdiagnose these kids, underdiagnose these kids, and neglect these kids medically, it leads to really poor outcomes. So, 1 in 20 kids have an FASD, y'all. And 80% of kids with FASDs never get diagnosed. We never diagnose them, y'all. And the reason the literature says from provider questionnaires is that most pediatric providers don't even survey. They don't even do surveillance for FASDs because they are not trained to do it. They feel uncomfortable doing it. They are concerned about the stigma related to FASDs. And a lot of us have stigmatizing attitudes, right? It's a part of our own biases as providers. And so they're often missed or inappropriately, they're misdiagnosed, or we just completely miss it all altogether. And when you get a late diagnosis, that leads to late interventions, and that leads to poor outcomes in their health, in their academics, in their social skills, their economics, their family outcomes. And you know, they end up with a shorter life expectancy than other folks with other neurodevelopmental disabilities, and they get criminalized, y'all. Kids who have FASDs end up being kicked out of school much more often than children with other disabilities. And because of the way their brains are wired, they have a really hard time learning from their mistakes and remembering the school rules. And because of their poor executive functioning, working memory, their cognitive rigidity, their behavior rigidity, their emotional dysregulation that are all a part of executive functioning, that stuff gets them in trouble. So then what ends up happening? So what do the statistics teach us? When you experience exclusionary punishment, y'all quit calling it school discipline. It's not discipline. It ain't teaching these kids nothing. They're being punished. It's called punishment. So when they get an out-of-school suspension or they get expelled from school, what ends up happening? Within a year, you end up in contact with the juvenile legal system. Dr. Franklin, why you call it juvenile legal? Ain't it juvenile justice? No, because it's not just. This criminal legal system is not just for everybody, but it's legal. So the juvenile legal system, did y'all know that about 60% of teenagers and adults in the juvenile legal system, I'm sorry, 60% of kids with FASDs have been in contact with law enforcement, and about half of them been arrested, and a lot of it happens in the school. And look at this statistic. Almost 25% of incarcerated youth have FASDs. Think about that. We've criminalized brain damage. Now let's talk about stigma. Stigma is real. And this Wilson article and this Rosen article are very good in talking about the stigma. And a lot of times we view folks with FASDs as labeled, as lazy, bad, they troublemakers. We criminalize them. We don't understand them. We punish them and we isolate them. And their caretakers get it too. They get blamed for their child's behavior. They're viewed as terrible parents. They're often misunderstood. Caregivers report feeling isolated from their communities and sometimes from their families. Caregivers, whether they are adopted or they are birth families, feel a lot of guilt and shame. And we, as healthcare providers, stigmatize these families. The education system stigmatizes them. Professionals in public places stigmatize them. So what that is that it's a barrier to even getting the healthcare that your child needs because of how you're treated. And let's talk real quick about intersectional ableism. Y'all, this is an Ottism. I made this word up a few years ago because I learned at a conference that disability is inherently intersectional. And my patients and your patients who are disabled experience multiple systems of oppression, right? And multiple systems of disadvantage. So if you look at this graphic, which comes from this beautiful, very incredibly, y'all, this is a sexy article that came out this year. They do not use the term intersectional ableism, but this is definitely what they're talking about. They call it the intersectional ecological framework, where they use the Bronfenbrenner ecological model, and they talk about the overlap of race, sex, and disability. Okay, think about FASD. And think about the criminal legal system as being a part of this intersectional ecological framework. So, from families to schools to peers to communities to workplaces, these folks have to deal with intersectional ableism. They're dealing with racist, gendered ableism. These kids with FASDs, this is what they're dealing with every day and for the rest of their lives. So, what do we do for these kids? What do we do? So, this is what I do. So, we have to survey. Perform surveillance for prenatal alcohol exposure because we don't yet have a really good screening tool, a validated screening tool. It's in the making, but a good validated screening tool that we as pediatric providers can use to screen our kids for prenatal alcohol exposure. So I explained that every single body gets the exact same questions. Care if you are pearls and you are at the country club and you live at a mountaintop. Or you are poorer than poor, and everything in between. I ask everybody this question: did you use alcohol, tobacco, or drugs before you found out you were pregnant? And let me tell you why I phrase it this way. As many of you know, a lot of folks don't consider themselves being pregnant until the pregnancy test is positive. Well, that might be 13, 14 weeks into the pregnancy, right? So, what did you do before the pregnancy test was positive, right? How much did you drink? Some people ask, how much alcohol, tobacco, and drugs you used before you were pregnant? How much did you use before you found out you were pregnant? Does that make sense? Across patients require documentation. That is really challenging. And I think that's a barrier to pediatric providers making the diagnosis. So you want to, oh, snap, my internet connection isn't good. Oh, no, the gremlin just showed up. You want to make sure that you are documenting the, pregnant person's history. Can y'all? Okay, y'all can still thank the Lord. Okay, it's still on. You want to make sure that you've got some kind of documentation of the pregnant person's alcohol use. And let me tell you what I ask foster care families or extended kinship is, did the person drink a lot before they got pregnant? And are they drinking a lot now after the baby is born, right? And there are some adoptive families that follow, they have some access to the birth family, like on social media, and they can see alcohol usage patterns. I don't ever ask that. I don't ask them to do that, but families have reported that to me. Okay. Now, this is a surveillance tool that I came up with. And last week at our AAP Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Champion Network meeting, I asked if we could use this acronym to come up with a surveillance rubric for pediatricians. Y'all got enough acronyms to remember from everything from the rooter to the tooter when it comes to seeing your kids. So why not just use FASD, hello, as another acronym? So this is what we came up with last week, y'all. This is hot off the presses. F stands for fetal alcohol exposure. A is for adaptive functioning. S is for self-regulation and social skills. And D is for delays in development and cognition. What do y'all think? So FASD is the diagnostic category we're asking y'all to survey these kids for, because it isn't screening because it's not a validated tool. But this will be, I think, an easier way for people to remember these are the things I'm looking for in diagnosing one of these FASDs, right? Hey, KISS, keep it simple and sweet. Now, these are some evidence-based interventions for folks with FASDs. We know that math learning disabilities are the most common learning disabilities. They're more prevalent in kids with prenatal alcohol exposure. So, MILE is a math learning intervention. GoFAR, is Focus, Act, and Reflect, really helps on self-regulation and like executive functioning. Work Buddies is very good for social skills. And Families Moving Forward is has a randomized controlled trial where parents are learning how to do behavior management for their children with FASDs. So the strategy that works is the positive behavior support system, y'all. Remember, behavior is a form of communication. I can't tell you how I'm feeling, so I'm going to show you. And what positive behavior supports do is they really help prevent the behavior problems. And we're training families to do so by really studying their child. My grandmother used to say, you got to study your kids so you know how to love them and you know how to raise them. So you got to understand how FASDs work in the body and keep your knowledge updated. You got to observe your kids' behavior and then you try to mitigate the triggers. So this is a lot more effective for kids with FASDs than consequence reward systems and token reward systems. Those don't work. We got to prevent the trigger. So let's think about the five reasons for behaviors. You want to either get attention, you want to escape attention, you want a tangible item, you want to avoid a task, or you want to meet a sensory need, right? These are the five. No, I'm out of time. I'm so sorry, Dr. Takayama. These are the five reasons for behavior. So then you want to identify the triggers for the behavior. Is it the environment? Is it too noisy? Is the light too bright? Is it too much going on? You want to look at the social factors. Well, is it the relationship the child has? Is it who they're interacting with? Look at the physical symptoms of the child. Are they hungry, thirsty, sleepy, tired, constipated, right? Look at the routine. Has there been a disruption in the routine? Did we change something? And then look at the task. Are we asking a kid who can't do addition to multiply? Like we skipped a step there. Are task demands overwhelming? If we can identify the trigger, and we can avoid the trigger, then we can avoid a lot of the disruptive behaviors. Y'all, this actually even works in adults with FASDs. Seriously. All right, y'all, this is a lovely, lovely tool from the NIAAA. I'm going to ask everybody go to the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism website. It's a government website. As of right now, I checked today, it's still working. We're not sure how long that's going to be. They have this tool for practitioners that you can download for free on how do you talk to your pediatric patients about alcohol use, starting y'all at the age of 8. Isn't that great? Okay, so FASDs are in the brain and not the face. It's the most common preventable form of brain damage and developmental disabilities in kids. 1 in 10 pregnant women drink alcohol in the United States and worldwide. Early diagnosis and evidence-based interventions work. And if we can prevent these kids from drinking, we can prevent FASDs. All right, y'all, I'm done. These are some resources. They're in your handout. You can put on here, tell me one thing that you've learned that would be very helpful if we have time.
Yeah,
Thank you.
thank
I'm sorry I
you.
ran over time. I'm
No,
sorry.
you are great. Thank you so much. And you probably can see all the positive responses, the emojis that are coming up. But just
Thank
thank you
you.
so much. And it's really compelling. We'll have to sort of work on the FASD mnemonic. I think some of the questions really tries they try to address the, are there specific therapies for FASD? And then I guess my tag on question is, are they available to everyone or everywhere?
That's the issue. The issue with any type of evidence-based therapeutic intervention is availability. Well, the good behavior game, for example, that social skills game, a lot of schools have it around the country. And it's really effective for kids with FASDs when it's done right. Also, if you've got the families moving forward, if you've got psychologists and other licensed mental health professionals who are trained in the positive behavior strategies, that alone could be very, actually very, very helpful, just in teaching families how to manage your kids' behaviors and figuring out the triggers. And a lot of times, parents are very good at telling you their kids' triggers, even if they don't have FASD. Most of us know what's going to set our kids off, right? And so identifying the triggers and developing a structure within the home and within the school that meets the kids' needs where they are, we have to exercise our cognitive and behavioral flexibility to meet the needs of the child rather than expecting the child to exercise flexibility to meet our demands. So those are things that I think are more available.
Larissa, do you have any questions?
Oh, what a fantastic talk. And you distilled how to support people so well. And we have a lot of questions. You definitely kept people engaged after lunch, so thank you for that. Would it be possible for you to, if you have time to spend any time on the questions and answers, because I don't think we'll be able to get through them all as a group, but I'm sure people would love to hear from you.
What do you want me to do?
One question was about if the mother has been drinking heavily for decades prior to pregnancy, and already has some poor liver function, is that also a risk for,
100%. 100%. If the pregnant person is drinking a lot before, if they have a history of alcoholism, you remember that is an addiction is a mental illness. And it is a sign of significant abuse and trauma that that person has experienced. We want to get them into treatment. And as Ms. Good, I keep referencing Ms. Good Pastor because she made such good points. Because fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are very high among many indigenous populations in the US. And that varies by tribe and by nation, because they ain't no monolith, y'all. They not a monolith, just like we ain't no monolith. And so there are specific FASD related interventions that that professions within tribes like the Lakota people have developed for themselves. And it's beautiful literature. If you put it into PubMed or Google Scholar and you say FASD Indigenous Populations US, you will see these studies and these rubrics that are very culturally tailored, and that are culturally responsive for those communities. So, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And I think we'll be talking later this afternoon about culturally tailoring interventions. So that's a great segue to later in the afternoon. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
Thank
you.
y'all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.